This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW, because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour, the boots that turn grocery aisles into runways, and all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between, because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
We have one more hour to go, including a conversation. This is going to be a tough one about the Cardinals with Tom Ackerman from the KMOX side of the building and the Cardinals Radio Network. He'll join me at the bottom of the hour. We have audio cut of the day as well. And then we're off and running here for the week. It's a little awkward just because Sue is not here. She's on a little bit of a break this week. Fred is still in Japan. He will be back on Thursday. Ethan is holding down the fort here with Matthew, and they're kind of helping me through the day because it gets a little lonely here in the studio. Jay Peter Zane is back with us this afternoon. He is an editor at Real Clear Investigations. He writes for Real Clear Politics, one of my favorite thinking pundits out there. Peter, welcome back to the show. How are you on this Monday?
I'm doing great. I wish I were in Japan. That sounds like a fun trip.
Fred was very nervous about it. Marie, his wife, is kind of the driving force, and Fred's a little bit nervous about kind of getting out of his comfort zone, but we've gotten some pictures, and it looks fantastic. You know, that was never a part of the world that I was fascinated with at all. I mean, if you would have asked me 10, 15 years ago, do you ever want to go to Asia, I probably would have said no, but it's become increasingly intriguing to me, so I can't wait to hear the details. Have you been?
I've been to Vietnam and Vietnam.
I've heard it's very nice,
which was
there
fantastic,
as well.
And I highly recommend it.
Absolutely,
great food, beautiful people.
I've heard great
things.
And
I got a suit there made for me in 2 days.
Really, like a custom suit?
Yeah, yeah. They do quick turnaround tailoring. So if you go there, get clothes, get shirts.
Here's what I'd say: Do people still in my world? Do people still wear suits, Peter? I guess you know important people like you do.
You know what? I got it, sadly, because I'm getting older for funerals. I needed a dark suit.
You know, I was on television for many, many years, going back to my days in Milwaukee, and I did this show on a Sunday morning, and I always had to wear a suit, and I had all kinds of suits. And this was back, like, when, if you go back to the early 2000s, remember, we were all wearing baggy suits, like really baggy suits, and then someone decided to show men how to dress.
Right.
I don't know who it was.
Well, I didn't get that memo, because if you could see me right now, it's a good thing I'm on the radio.
Well, let's talk politics here. You know, I've seen a lot. You wrote a column last week called The Democrats' Path Out of the Wilderness. We don't want to help them too much here, but there's some common themes that you've written about and some other folks out there when it comes to, you know, what's happening on the other side. And I'm continuously baffled by their position on these 80-20 issues, the 90-10 issues, which don't seem to be helping them in any way, shape, or form. But your thoughts here moving forward?
Well, I mean, two things. One is, I think that there are a couple problems that they have. One is that they're true believers. The 10% of the people who control the party are, in fact, left-wing activists, and they are ideologues. And so they believe in open borders. They believe in DEI. They believe in, using, I don't know actually what they believe about Russia, because I think that's a thing of convenience, but globalism, supporting NATO. So these are positions that are intrinsic to them. So it's going to be very hard to give it up. It's particularly hard for the Democrats because they have always been a top-down party. If you go even before the Civil War, you know, they were basically the Southern planters. Then they were the machine politicians. Then they've become the progressives, FDR, the experts. But they've always been a small group of people empowered by money and or knowledge who knew what was best for everybody else. And it's very hard then with that tradition to change, to have somebody come in and really shake things up like you saw with Trump and the Republican Party. And that's really what they need, is they need a Trump. They need somebody to come in and change the paradigm. And I don't know if that's possible.
I don't know if it's possible either, just because, let me ask this question. The favorability among voters is at the bottom of the barrel right now. So in a poll from CNN recently, the favorability toward the Democratic Party was locked in about 29%. That was down 10 points before the election. But some of that has to come from two different places. So in other words, people that just can't stand what the Democrats are doing right now, and they don't understand, you know, their positions on a variety of issues like the 90-10 issues. But there's also dissatisfaction that pops up in that number, Peter, with progressives who don't think that their party is crazy enough. My words. Isn't that part of the equation as well?
Perfect. You nailed it. Republicans, conservatives should not put too much stock in those things. Because a lot of the low numbers are the super radical people who are not happy with the way things are going and want the party to basically self-immolate. You know, they want them to take, because, I mean, one of the things you think about is, what would a resistance stand for? Should they say that we need open borders? Should they say that we should have racist policies in corporations? I mean, what you basically have had is the Democratic Party, and they believe in these things, and they think that they're enlightened policies or whatever, but they have continually pushed a series of deeply unpopular policies with 70% of the people. And the way they've done it is, and this has led to the polarization, is by demonizing the other side. So they have very effectively, we used to say that politics is sort of like sports and who your team is. It's Israel and the Palestinians. I mean, it's that level of fear and hatred. And there's very hard to see on the extremes, and those are the people who tend to push things a little bit, any reconciliation. And so what the left has done, in my opinion, is the liberals said, we can't stand up to these awful racist Republicans. We're too soft. So they empowered the left, which is willing to fight with brass knuckles, and the left has now pushed all of these policies and created an environment where, as bad as we are, you cannot vote for the other side. They are beyond the pale. So I don't know how you, in the long run, are going to, or, you know, in the short to medium run, change the dynamic of that party, because even the liberals, and, you know, they could shed a few, but are still convinced that Trump is the devil.
Right. But you also have, like, I don't know if you saw Don Lemon on Bill Maher's podcast last week talking about how AOC is somehow the standard bearer. So who are the people, you know, this question gets asked, who's running the Democrat Party? Is it Gavin Newsom? He's certainly trying to take control. I pointed out on Friday, and I heard an interview on Friday with Rahm Emanuel, the former mayor of Chicago, obviously a key person in the Obama administration. I think Rahm Emanuel's a guy that's trying to change the narrative right now. And he may be a guy that can potentially do that. I mean, he was a terrible mayor, but they're going to have to bring people back to the center. But how in the world can some people think that AOC and Bernie Sanders should be the standard bearer moving forward?
Because those are the voices of the 10% that run the party. And this is what they think and believe. They believe this stuff. They are committed to it. It's like the universities. I mean, those professors, many of them, especially in the humanities, are true believers in all of this nonsense. And Max Planck said had a great quote, which got paraphrased, and that is, science proceeds one funeral at a time. So these people are so committed to these ideas that they're never going to change, and you have to wait for them to expire or somehow be dislodged. And I don't know especially given how much the Democratic Party relies on money from a small group of super wealthy people, that you could really challenge the system in some ways. Because it's not just Romney, it's not these political people, it's, you know, big money, George Soros, all those people. And one other element, which I haven't quite figured out in my thinking yet, but did you see that NBC poll about how different groups of Americans feel about Trump and Vance?
I have not seen that one, no.
Okay, so basically it echoed a story that Joel Kotkin wrote for Real Clear Investigations 2 years ago. And in that he found that the largest group that supports the Democrats is single women. And Democrats win that by 40 points. And this poll showed that college-educated white women are 90% of them hate Trump, hate Vance, whatever. Same was true, actually, for men, white men without college degrees. But one of the other things to really pay attention to is that the Democratic Party is increasingly becoming the party of unattached women. Not just that, but a lot of that. And that affects who they are, how they think, how they process information, is a huge part of why AOC, because women are very appealing to a party that is deeply dependent
right.
on women.
Well, that makes more sense that way. How does, you know, because one of the things we've been talking about quite a bit last week and this week, it's getting a lot of attention. We had a protest here in Chesterfield where there's a Tesla dealership. How does that play into all of this? Because it's the most ridiculous thing. It's logically flawed. It doesn't make any sense to protest a guy you think is a Nazi because he made a car that someone else is driving and they didn't make that decision based on the philosophy of the owner. But they're going nuts on this stuff right now, Peter.
Yeah, well, it's the peaceful protest. And so what you say, you know, I remember in like 2014, and there was this eruption of these demonstrations on campus, and Charles Murray spoke somewhere, a conservative thinker, and other people, and they got attacked, and there was all this concern about campuses being unsafe. And then it kind of went away for a couple of years. And then it came back with a vengeance in the Black Lives Matter movement. And now we're seeing it again, not quite at that level, but, you know, street violence is an important element of Democratic strategy when they're out of power. I'm not saying that the party is directing these people. And what happens is the media and their enablers create an environment where it's okay. Oh, this is a backlash.
Yeah, right.
We did it. It's always the other side did something, and the left is responding, when it's actually the exact opposite of that. You remember during COVID? It's like nobody was wearing a mask. Then we were told, you have to wear a mask. And then when you said, I got a problem wearing a mask, oh, you're creating problems. No,
yeah, that was
the problem. You made me do something I wasn't doing.
Right. No, I completely agree with that. And I would, because I'm fascinated, you're a political guy, I'm fascinated by how this is somehow going to come together for the Democrats. I mean, what do you make of Gavin Newsom's podcast right now?
I think it's a good opportunity to test the waters, to try. In other words, he knows that the way he had been selling himself, it is not going to win. And his problem is that he's actually not just espoused things, he's implemented things. So his task is particularly difficult because he's running a state that is going down the drain, you know? And so he's got to rehabilitate himself to the point where he can deny his record to some extent, to sort of pull off the Kamala Harris thing, you know? All the while, probably, you know, he's going to implement those things again. But what do you think?
Well, yeah, that's what he's trying to redefine himself. He's slick. You know, I think that Gavin Newsom is certainly very, very polished, and he's got nice hair and he looks pretty. So he can say things and he can convince people in ways that maybe other politicians can't, because he's a pretty boy and he's got a sharp tongue. But I do think it's interesting. You know, there's a couple of folks that I follow that have been writing things along the same lines as you, Peter. One is Rye Teixeira over at the Liberal Patriot. And one of the things that he highlighted was some of the things that are happening in these Democratic states, including Illinois. These are states that are losing something, thousands and thousands of people to Florida and to Texas. Both of those states gain 2 million residents. So some of the stuff that's happening in politics is definitely affecting the geography as well.
And it's what's interesting, too, though, is that they're losing people who probably are not dyed-in-the-wool progressives. Because I live in North Carolina, and we have had a huge influx of people from the Northeast, including myself, although I've been here a while. But it, in fact, has not turned the state purple. It's as red as it has ever been. And so you look at Florida, you look at all these places. So what may happen is these states they're fleeing may become even deeper blue and even more one party and more corrupt, because any kind of resistance is like, I'd rather switch than fight.
I think that's a great
point. I
mean,
I don't know that demographically. But
no, but I think that that's a pretty good hunch if that's what it is. That can certainly happen. Peter Zane, always great to have you on. I appreciate you joining me on a Monday afternoon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, take care. You know, I mentioned Ride to Sheriff because he wrote something that was interesting in the Liberal Patriot along the lines of, you know, we just...
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code SHAVE at checkout. That's harrys.com, code SHAVE. Enjoy!
Survivor 48 is here. And after every episode, dig deep into the show with On Fire, the official Survivor podcast. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
Talked about the geography there, though, but just the way that the party registration is happening. This happened in Pennsylvania. One of the things that Rye said is identification with the Democrat Party. Nothing looms as large in driving political behavior than party identification, which party voters identify with or lean toward. Lately, this is what he wrote today in the Liberal Patriot. Something astonishing has happened. Republicans have led in party identification for 3 straight years. That has not happened in nearly a century. And the trend doesn't show any sign of abating in the aftermath of what happened in the election. And the GOP continues to outregister Democrats in states like Pennsylvania, Nevada, North Carolina. Over time, these are pretty important numbers here. 4 states. California, just 4 states, California, Colorado, Delaware, and New York. Delaware is still a state in other news, have seen Democrats outregistering Republicans compared to 22 states where Republicans have been gaining. Then he gets into the, you know, the geography and how many people have left California and Illinois. You also go into the educated versus uneducated. It turns out that being widely disliked in huge parts of the country matters a lot, he writes. These 4 factors indicate a party that is truly in a deep hole. The party's severe image, identification, governance, and geographic weaknesses cannot be remedied by mounting the rhetorical barricades against Trump and waiting for his administration to self-destruct. So the bottom line is, it's really good news if you're rooting on the Republicans, because they don't have a path to gain these voters back. And then you hear some of this in the polling, for example, on CNN.
63%, according to the latest Fox News poll, say that they favor deporting those immigrants. So that's a pretty high number.
And you hear Dana Bash and others on CNN, they're apoplectic about that. They cannot believe that people support some of the horrific things like taking the country back that Donald J. Trump represents. We're going to take a break. We're coming back. We'll talk a little baseball, as painful as that might be. It's not going to be as painful as maybe when the games start. We're going to hope for the best with the Cardinals. Tommy Ackerman, my I guess he's still my colleague. Over on the KMOX side, the Cardinals Radio Network is going to join us with a preview. We'll talk some Blues hockey as well. Great time on Friday at Assumption Parish in South County. We'll do it all again on Friday of this week. In fact, I think Ethan's just knocked down the locked in the roundtable panel. Jane will be back, State Senator Mary Elizabeth Coleman, and Jeff Rainford, former Chief of Staff for Mayor Slay. Look, we're a week away. I was thinking about this. Actually, truth be told, I think about it every day when I come into downtown, that we're counting the days and maybe the hours now when Tashar Jones will not be the mayor. It is disgusting to me. I've threatened to do this for a while, and I'll have to see if I actually do it because I'm afraid I might get arrested. But it's a very big pet peeve of mine for those of you who come down to Enterprise Center, or you know the area around City Hall. We're only about two blocks from there. And they, a year and a half ago when Kamala Harris came to town in 2023, a year and a half ago in October, they put these, you know, gates around Pelker Park, which is located just to the south of where I'm sitting right now. And they put them around City Hall and the courts building as well, because all the homeless encampments were there. But they haven't opened it back up. Like, no one's taken those gates down. I don't know what it's going to take. They claimed, because I had to do a Freedom of Information request, the parks director and others claimed that they were doing repairs to the grass at Pelker Park. But I bring it up, and the reason it's a pet peeve of mine, it's very symbolic of the failure of this administration and this city. Having those gates up there for a year and a half, eventually they'll come down. I think I might, next Tuesday, when Tashar loses, I think I might just go around and take him down, see if I get arrested. It'd be good radio if I do get arrested. All right, let's talk a little sports here with Tom Ackerman from down the hall at the KMOX side of the building. He's the KMOX sports director, also on the Cardinals Radio Network, and he does so much more. Hi, Tommy. How are you this afternoon?
Doing great, buddy. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm a little nervous about this baseball season, but before I get to that, let me get your thoughts on hoops. Illinois goes out this weekend. Mizzou, of course, does the Mizzou thing. What the hell happened to them? Let's start there. What do you think happened there?
Yeah, it was a bummer. I mean, they went up against a good team. That was a bad matchup for them, I felt. You know, Missouri thrives on transition. They thrive on, like, an up-and-down game, mistakes being made by the other team and feasting on them. And Drake doesn't like either of those things. Drake likes to play efficient offense. They like to run the clock down, and then they bury you with a good pass inside, or they hit a three from the outside, and they're very well coached. Ben McCollum actually just got the Iowa job.
Yeah, I saw
that. Officially today. So, you know, they're a really good team, and I thought it was a bad matchup for Missouri. And Missouri did not play well down the stretch. I mean, their defense was lacking. They were living and dying by the three, and if those threes don't go down, Mizzou isn't very good. I thought that Illinois, you know, when they're really good, they're scary good, and sometimes they can be unpredictable. They were a little bit in between yesterday against a really good Kentucky team, and it's no shame in losing to Kentucky. You just wish that Illinois could have a little more consistency. But, you know, the name of the college game today, it's difficult to do. I'm not making an excuse for them, but when you change over that many people from year to year, you've got to get the right mix and chemistry. And I always felt like Illinois was a good team, but not great. They at times, again, look like a killer, but if you don't have everybody playing on the same page all the time and everybody healthy,
yeah, it's tough. Yeah.
You know, you can't get it done.
Well, and on the Mizzou front, you know, now the question becomes, look, I could argue, I had someone that sent me something about college athletics and, you know, said, look, they've ruined college athletics. A lot of people feel that way with NIL. My feeling is this is the landscape that we're dealing with right now. It's a bit of the Wild West. Some things have settled down, but there's no way in my mind that Mizzou could go from 0-18 in the SEC to what they did this year without, you know, the transfer portal and NIL. Now, though, we're in a situation, again, you got some kids that might stay. I mean, I think there's an assumption that Mark Mitchell stays. Cruz says that he's coming back. But some of these other kids might decide, like Aiden Shaw might say, hey, I want to go into the portal. So now you have this turnover situation again, and the coaching staff has to figure this out.
Yeah, and some players go into the portal just to see if any teams will bite, and then sometimes they come back.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really a matter of, we need to regulate this thing. I mean, you can't just let players come and go and play for four different teams in their career. I know that coaches can do it, but, you know, players should be able to have some sort of guideline here. I mean, schools should have some sort of guideline. I mean, whether it's players can only move every 2 years, or, you know, there has to be some sort of a restriction based on just moving around. But look, it is the world that we're in. And, you know, it does take a special coach. And I think Gates is one of those who can pull a group together and get them all moving in one direction. And I do think that with a different draw, we might be talking differently about Missouri. I mean, we just saw it this year. They beat Florida. They beat Alabama. They're capable of dropping 100 on somebody. But it has to be the right matchup. And I thought that when I saw the Drake draw, I'm like, oh, no.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
everybody
like
did.
The worst thing that could happen. Yeah.
I was kind of sitting back saying, look, and I knew how good Drake was. I had seen them in the MVC tournament here. But I thought, you know what, we're in the upper echelon of the SEC, and they're in the MVC, and that's going to end up being a difference maker. And it wasn't. By the way, on the SEC front, they get seven teams in the Sweet 16.
They do. You know, the Big Ten was really good. The Big Ten was undefeated there for a while. So those are the two power conferences. The ACC did not do all that well. Duke has got a chance to go all the way. But other than that, the ACC is pretty weak. I think the Missouri Valley Conference takes a hit from this NIL situation and portal situation because these schools don't have the deep pockets, so they're basically like farm teams for the big schools. I mean, how many Big Ten and SEC players come out of the Valley and do well? But you occasionally will get a Drake. You will get, you know, some other teams like Bradley who can do it. The problem is there's so much money tied up in this now, and you've got these big schools that the Missouri Valley Conference. I mean, what if Drake had not won Arch Madness? I bet you they don't get in. I mean, I'd like to think they would.
No, they probably don't.
But we said the same thing about Indiana State last year. And then what if they don't get in? A team that won 30 games during the regular season. So it's a little bit odd right now. You've got a heavy, heavy contingent of SEC and Big Tens. It makes for, you know, a lot of viewership. I mean, I think that mostly the networks probably enjoy the fact that all these big teams are still involved.
I think you're right about that. Let's get to the Cardinals. Tom Ackerman is here as we get closer to opening day. The decision over the last couple of days was the roster being finalized, and there was a lot of buzz about Victor Scott. Will he make it? Won't he make it? The fans, I think, were saying, look, this guy's had an incredible spring. How can you keep him off the roster? So in the end, they keep him on the roster. But what went down there, Tom, in your opinion?
Well, I think that, you know, he is the people's choice at center field. And I think that, you know, inside the Cardinals talked a lot about it, and they were keeping an eye on it with the thought that if he does finish strong, they're going to make him the center fielder. You know, Cardinals fans right now are looking at this team and saying, what are we? I mean, is this a team that can win? Is this a team that's going to develop players only? No, it's neither. It's a team that's sort of in between. So I think fans were being vocal and saying, at least give us something. At least give us an exciting young player like Victor Scott to play center field. And quite honestly, Mark, he earned it. I mean, he was the best outfielder they had in spring training. He has shown absolutely all of his skills, and he's improved from one year to the next. So now he's going to get that shot. The Cardinals will have some flexibility out there. They can play Nootbaar in center. They can play Ciani in center if they have to. One curious move was that they had Ciani still on the team, though, as a fourth outfielder. So that knocks out Fermin and Barrero, who are competing for an infield-outfield spot. They're basically playing with no backup shortstop right now, except for Brendan Donovan, who will move all over the place. So they're going for big power hitters. Outside of Scott and a couple of others, they're going for the big thumpers, Baker, Burleson, Gorman coming off the bench, and then rolling the dice that, you know, Wynn will be okay at shortstop. They still have the backups in Memphis if they have to. But going back to Scott, I think it is exciting. He is a fun, fun talent. He's explosive. He's a big personality. And, you know, the Cardinals could use a little bit of that. They could use a little personality.
Absolutely. And does that mean, so, like, let's talk about Jose Fermin, because he really had a good spring. He worked hard. He's going to get up here, though, right?
Yeah, he'll be one of those players that you can go get if you need a second baseman, third baseman, shortstop. He can even play in the outfield. He's just your classic infielder who has a good bat, good contact hitter, and there's nothing really wrong with him necessarily. They just felt like a bigger impact would be to go with the other guys. Ciani is an excellent fielder that you could put in there in late innings, so I understand their thinking there. I might have gone with Barrero as an exciting talent who can play shortstop, outfield, and can hit a home run every so often. Fermin's not really a home run hitter, but, you know, it is what it is. The Cardinals' bench is stacked right now with power. I think the only interesting part of this from that standpoint is how do they give Gorman his at-bats? He's not the second baseman. That's Donovan. He'll play it sometimes. He's not the third baseman because they couldn't trade Arenado. he's not the primary DH, or is he? Or is it Burleson? Or is it Herrera? I mean, they're going to have to be very creative in how they get Nolan Gorman his at-bats.
What is the current status of Jordan Walker? I mean, 2 years ago, we're talking about this guy as being one of the next, you know, stars in the whole league, not just on the Cardinal, and the Cardinals, Tom. So what he was injured maybe a little bit a couple of weeks ago, too. Where is Jordan Walker in all of this right
now?
Well,
I'm pretty impressed. In the short term, like right now, I'm impressed with how fast he came back from that injury, because that could have been bad. He stepped on a sprinkler head in right field, a la Mickey Mantle back in the day. This was in West Palm Beach. He wrenched his knee. He had inflammation around the knee. I was thinking worst-case scenario. But it's structurally no damage. So in very short order, probably 10 or 11 days, he was back on the field just to get himself back. And he actually stung the ball pretty well. He looked pretty good at the plate before that. I think there's a lot of expectation placed on him because he was their top prospect. I think that he was moved quickly to the outfield, a position that he wasn't accustomed to playing. And that might have affected a little bit. I think that his play at the plate, I think that his play at the plate has been so up and down. He was, remember, moved to the minors to work on it and then brought back up. And then, you know, he just hasn't been able to catch his stride yet. But he's so young. He's wise for a young guy. I think he's a student of the game for sure. I still think he has untapped power in that bat. And they will need him to be good. I mean, if the Cardinals are going to be good, I think their bullpen is good. I think their rotation's pretty good. I think that they just have to hit. If they hit a little bit last year, they're probably knocking on the door of the playoffs, whereas this past year they were horrendous offensively and didn't make it. I think that Walker, though, is a big part of this.
Yeah.
If Walker is good, they could be pretty decent. Everyone's going to have to be good in that lineup.
Let me make an analogy, and I'll go back to Mizzou real quick, because one of the things I said after the loss, Tom, was, look, it wasn't really too difficult to handicap some of this because they did stumble into the end of the season and lost 4 of 6. I want to bring up Sonny Gray, because maybe Sonny Gray is working on some pitches, but what would there be a realistic expectation for the fans to say, hey, this guy's going to turn it around after a brutal spring?
Oof, yeah, I'm concerned about that a little bit. Now, I know that some are not. You know, I've heard some people on our station, and I've heard the Cardinals say that they trust Sonny Gray, but I don't like when a pitcher is throwing 89, 90 when he's accustomed to throwing 94. It means that he's got to basically take that fastball out of his arsenal. He can't blow that by people anymore. It's almost like, it's not this bad, but it's almost like Wainwright, when he didn't have the velocity anymore, he was getting shelled. I mean, I think Gray is a better pitcher at this stage than Wainwright was at the latter stage of his career. But to that end, Gray is going to have to be creative in throwing breaking balls, keeping hitters off balance with all kinds of movement and changing speeds. And you just have to hope that he can figure it out until he gets the velocity back. It's not anything more than he got a late start because he had a forearm tendon injury. And he had to have an injection, so everything's kind of a little bit late for him in terms of getting that velocity back. At least that's what he's saying. So it's definitely something to watch. Now, the good news is you have this guy in the minors right now, Michael McGreevy, who was phenomenal in the spring. And I'm not saying that lightly. I mean, he was really, really good against big competition. So I'd be very curious to see if something doesn't go right with this rotation when they make that call for McGreevy.
I'll leave on this. Look, there's a lot of anxiety on the part of the fans. I've heard from fans across the country. You know, we all have friends who are deep, seated Cardinals fans. But there's a lot of people saying, I'm mad at Mo. I don't want to even watch the team. Obviously, exceeding expectations can turn that around, but there's a lot of sentiment here that needs to be turned around.
Yeah, so fans of the Cardinals are used to winning, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's not being spoiled. That's just the fact of life. They've won a lot of championships. They've always had good teams. You know, unless you experienced Cardinal baseball in the 70s, which was not a great era, most of our lives have been great baseball. If you're my age, I turned 50 this year. My early memories are the 80s. And I was a fan of the team in the 80s. Ever since then, except for that brief period where the Brewery owned the team, you know, they have had a really good run. So, you know, fans are used to that. So they're upset when things don't go well, but they also like to be told what's going on. They want to be involved. They like to know that they have a say and that it's being communicated to them clearly. I think once Heim Bloom has the ability to do that and takes over as a spokesman for this team, that will show a little bit more, because really what's happening here is what's going on at the lowest level of their organization. They are reshaping everything. You know, and on top of that, Cardinals fans have a lot of pride. Just like St. Louis, you know how we always defend our city? And when people start talking trash about St. Louis, we get upset. And after a while, we just sort of throw our hands up. That's how Cardinals fans are right now. They're tired of people saying, boy, your team, I don't know about all that. I mean, they're used to being National League royalty. I mean, we ran that division here in St. Louis forever. So to take a step back and being told that the Cardinals have one of the worst lineups in baseball, et cetera, really does not sit well with the team and so with fans. So they're going to point the finger, and I get it. I get it. And they're passionate. I just hope that they continue to understand it's our responsibility to explain, let them interact and vent, and then see if we can take this thing back to where it used to be.
Tom, I appreciate it. I ran a little long here. I would be remiss in my duties if I didn't give you at least, 45 or 60 seconds to rave on the Blues right now, because holy moly, that's been fun, right?
Dude, you know I could talk to you for an hour if I had to. The Blues, just real quick, are starting to. I don't want to get too excited here, but they're starting to remind me of 2019. Coaching change when things weren't going well, and now they just can't be stopped. And they've got that mix of youth and veteran leadership. They're playing out of their minds right now. They've won six in a row. Mark, they're the best team in the NHL since the Four Nations faceoff. 12-2-2 since that competition. This has been a remarkable run by the Blues. They're 4 points clear of the competition for the second wild card. They're actually 4 points behind Minnesota for the top wild card. If they get into the playoffs, I think it'll be a tough out.
Yeah, it's amazing, really. This is exciting, and you can kind of feel it right now, especially because maybe our other teams are potentially letting us down. Tom, it's great to have you on, of course, and I really appreciate it. Enjoy opening day.
Thank you, buddy.
We used
Good
to do
talk
these.
To you always.
Yeah, we used to do these things together. Remember, I'm old
we
enough
did.
To remember when Tom Ackerman and Mark Reardon hosted opening day coverage, but then I went to the FM. But I'll miss you.
And now we're FM. How about that?
I know. I've heard rumors to that effect. All right, Ackerman, we'll see you.
All right, man.
Well, we're trying to get the week started on a good note, because we got Sue and Fred off until later this week, and then Ethan's off on Thursday. So getting the whole team together is a little challenging. Spring break time, what can you say? But we do have audio cut of the day before we leave here for the afternoon, so let's get to that.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
Well, I've got a few here this afternoon. This is from Edmonton in Canada at a city council meeting. I thought this was very important today.
Today, to recognize Two-Spirit and Indigenous LGBTQIA+ Awareness Day. The Two-Spirit flag showcases a rainbow with two eagle feathers to symbolize the balance of masculine and feminine spirits. The celebration at City Hall featured drumming and cultural performances.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about this. The battles of Indigenous trans warriors in Canada has to be one of the most undercover topics in world history, if you're thinking about it. Then there's Caitlin Bennett, who went out to Florida Spring Breakers and asked them some pretty easy questions.
The three branches of the U.S. government.
The legislature. I don't know.
Oh, my.
Dude, I do know this, but I'm blanking.
Yeah, I feel like I... Legislative.
There's an E involved.
Yeah. Teachers would be
saying. Yeah. Wait, I can't even think. I can't.
Judicial and.
Oh.
Starts with an E.
Did my mom's gonna kill me?
Yeah.
I don't know. Executive.
No, okay.
So who's in charge of the executive branch?
Uh-oh. That's a tough one.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
I don't know. What are the three branches of the U.S. government?
Legislative.
Uh-huh.
You go next.
Yeah, it's not getting any better either.
How many U.S. senators are in the U.S. government?
Four.
Four, okay.
Five. Three.
How many U.S. senators are there?
12.
What?
Is it a high number?
Okay, who won the Civil War?
America.
Oh, good. Great.
I thought it was Superman. Oh, shoot. It's East or West, right?
Not quite.
Wait. What is it?
Well, it was a close one because Captain America, like, fought Spider-Man.
Captain America and Iron Man, like, fought.
He fought the Winter Soldier.
What body of water are we next to right now?
The ocean?
Well, there's different types.
Oh, my God.
Pacific?
Atlantic?
No. Bro, what? Hold on, no, babe. I know it's not the Caribbean.
No.
The Gulf of Mexico? Gulf of Mexico, yeah. Well, now America. Gulf
there
of America.
You go. Gulf of America.
Hey, they finally got one right there. The Gulf of America. That is... Now, look, I've played montages like that before, and my hope is always that when you edit them, you're taking the goofiest and the dumbest answers, right? We're going to hope and pray that a lot of the Utes from around the country that were spring breaking down in Florida could answer those basic questions. But honestly, I do not know. Enjoy your Monday night. We'll be back tomorrow at 3. We got Telephone Tuesday in the 4 o'clock hour. We'll take some calls tomorrow.